From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. The long-promised immigration enforcement actions came to Chicago this weekend. ICE officials said they arrested 1,000 people nationwide on Sunday, but would not say how many were in Illinois. Those figures, by the way, are from the Chicago Tribune, which also noted that the Biden administration averaged 310 immigration arrests per day. Now, Illinois law prohibits local authorities from cooperating with federal immigration officials on civil enforcement. But these early arrests are purportedly targeting people who have been convicted or accused of criminal activity. Meanwhile, Illinois was one of a number of states that sued and temporarily blocked President Donald Trump's executive order reinterpreting the constitutional provision that says, if you're born in America, you're an American citizen. All these issues and more have been top of mind for Illinois' Attorney General, Kwame Raoul. He's a Democrat who's been in office since 2019. In order to accommodate his schedule, we spoke late Friday afternoon. That's worth emphasizing, Friday afternoon, because the immigration raids had not yet come to Chicago. But there's still a lot here, including his deeply personal perspective on birthright citizenship. Attorney General Kwame Raoul, welcome back to the 21st Show.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be.
I want to begin by asking you, because Illinois, like many states, is grappling with a host of legal challenges under the new Trump administration. What is top of mind for you as you assess the potential battles ahead?
Well, first off, I think it's important, and I like starting out with that question, because I think it's important even for people who don't have a sensitivity to some of the subject matter areas that some of the executive orders impact. You know, so an individual may not have a sensitivity to birthright citizenship. They might have not have a sensitivity to the DOJ memo suggesting to investigate, prosecute local officials. But most people care about the United States Constitution. And I think that is a consistent theme that has it underlines the audacity of some of the early moves, the disregard for the plain language of the 14th Amendment, a disregard for among some of those who used to be the most vocal about the 10th Amendment and states' rights, for the balance that's created through the 10th Amendment and the anti-commandeering doctrine that grows out of the 10th Amendment that Justice Scalia once articulated well in an opinion. So what strikes me most that I think all Americans should be concerned about is a president and his administration coming out of the gate with a disregard for our United States Constitution.
So you mentioned the 14th Amendment. That is birthright citizenship, right there, Section 1. Your office, along with attorneys general in other states, obtained a temporary restraining order against a presidential executive order on this subject. Can you just talk about the constitutional arguments at play and how Illinois is proceeding in this case?
Yeah, I mean, it's really fundamental. Section 1 of the 14th Amendment says that someone born in the United States or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof is a citizen of the United States and a resident of the state wherein they live. I think a first or second grader can understand Section 1 of the 14th Amendment. It's a provision that grows out of a response to the Dred Scott decision post-Civil War, where the Dred Scott decision was trying to deny citizenship to former enslaved people. So symbolically, it has meaning beyond the challenges that we're facing with immigration that should alarm people about the disregard for it. Interestingly, the judge in the district court in Washington, a Reagan appointee, his language in the hearing was something that people should know. He called it blatantly unconstitutional, and he questioned how any lawyer, any member of the bar, could even appear before the court and try to make an argument about the constitutionality of the court. So he didn't just say, oh, yeah, let me analyze this and try to determine whether it's unconstitutional. It's just unconstitutional on its face. It's blatantly unconstitutional. And I think that's important.
Of course, the Constitution really means what nine people on the United States Supreme Court are willing to say it means. Are you confident that this Supreme Court will recognize what has been the precedent since the late 1800s? There was a man who was born to Chinese immigrants who sort of established this right. That was the precedent, right? There was a case that sort of established what this meant in the way we understand it today. Do you think there's a chance that that could be overturned?
I don't believe so. I mean, this is not a Dobbs versus Roe v. Wade sort of complexity. Although I disagree with the Dobbs decision, there it wasn't just a simple question, just plain, unambiguous language and a constitutional amendment. I'm confident in all nine justices' capacity to read plain language, and they're remaining true to their historic philosophy that where there's plain and unambiguous language, you don't try to go figure things out from there. You don't even go to legislative history or anything like that. You just read the plain language and you apply it. And that's been their very conservative ideology as to how to approach the Constitution. I don't see any reason why it should change now.
Yeah, I have seen some conservatives trolling liberals who are saying, oh, suddenly liberals are interested in originalism now, the plain textualism. We'll see where that carries them. I'm curious how this sort of effort comes together. This has become pretty standard in the modern era. Maybe that's a recency bias on my part, that attorneys general band together to oppose what the federal government might be doing. We saw that with Republican attorneys general during the Biden administration. We saw it in the first Trump administration. We saw it this week. How do these efforts come together? How do you decide which states to ban with? What is the process?
Well, it's interesting. And I've gotten to know, all 50 state attorneys general. People often ask me what's going on in Springfield. I say, I don't know. I'm out of state meeting with attorneys general. And it's not only on a partisan basis, it's bipartisan. I've developed friendships with Republican attorneys general as well. And there's a number of matters that we work on together.
Opioids and the Sacklers and things like that, I would imagine.
It's from social media, a number of issues, vaping, antitrust on college athletics and a number of issues. And we've gotten to know each other, and we've actually gotten to know each other's families. And so with regards to the issues that tend to separate us on a partisan ideological basis, and in particular, this sort of crisis we're facing now, it's probably no secret to anybody that we didn't start our work on some of these issues on Monday, right? We anticipated, Project 2025 was out there for everybody to see, and Agenda 47, as well as the things that was coming out of the then candidate, now president's mouth. He was speaking. I remember when I was running for attorney general the first time, he was speaking about questioning birthright citizenship. And I remember in his speech saying, hey, I am my birthright babe. My mother was not a citizen at the time of my birth, so it's an issue that's quite personal to me. But as we do on a wide variety of issues, we've met and started preparing for things that we could anticipate would happen in a change of administration, even before we knew the results of the election.
Let's turn now to another aspect of, I guess, this broad area that we call immigration law. You recently issued updated guidance reaffirming that Illinois law enforcement cannot be used to enforce federal immigration laws. What challenges are you anticipating in maintaining that boundary?
You've probably heard or read the Department of Justice memo that suggests to investigate or prosecute any state or local officials that don't collaborate with civil immigration enforcement efforts. Before I go into this, I want to preface with saying that I, as a head of the Attorney General's office, while our office is multifaceted, we have a criminal prosecution side to our office. And on that side of the office, we frequently on daily, week-to-week basis. We collaborate with the FBI, the DEA, the ATF, Secret Service, and Homeland Security investigations on a wide range of criminal investigation. Some cases that we prosecute where they think it's better prosecuted in state court, and some cases that may be prosecuted by the U.S. attorney in federal court. These cases range from child pornography cases to human trafficking, drug trafficking, gun trafficking, fraud, and so on. Targets of investigations are citizens and non-citizens alike. So it's important not to confuse the Trust Act with ongoing and or new criminal investigations. I say that because the prioritization that has been articulated by the president to start with those who have committed criminal acts. There's nothing in the Trust Act that prevents local or state law enforcement agency from collaborating in criminal investigations. So we have to be careful as to how we talk about this, because it's a little bit of a trick bag when you say, hey, well, if you're not cooperating with civil immigration enforcement, you're threatening the public safety, or it's kind of the
opposite. And to be clear, when you say criminal investigations, as long as immigration status is not the only thing that's against the law, right? There has to be some other sort of theft or violence or something. Yeah.
Much of these immigration enforcement is civil enforcement. It's not criminal enforcement.
Sure, sure.
But the other aspect of public safety to this is, as we investigate these cases, sometimes witnesses and or victims are undocumented immigrants. And we have what's called U visas at the federal government to encourage collaboration with law enforcement in the interest of public safety for all of us. We want these people to feel comfortable coming forth, either as victims or as witnesses. So there's a real public safety interest in protecting these individuals.
Just to be clear about that for listeners, see, what you're saying is, if you'd rather have somebody who's undocumented witnesses a murder, for example, feel comfortable coming forward to help catch the murderer and not have to worry that that's going to jeopardize their immigration, getting deported.
That's correct. And that's not the end of it, though. That's not the end of it. If there's a murder or a sexual assault committed by an undocumented immigrant in the state of Illinois, the people of the state of Illinois rely on law enforcement officials within the state of Illinois to hold that individual responsible and make sure that they're convicted and they're penalized for the crime that they have committed. So if the answer is, well, just deport them even before you convict them, then you're not holding them responsible for the crime that they committed. What's to say that they don't find a way to sneak back into the country after they're free? They've been deported and they're free. What's to say they don't figure out how to get around Donald Trump's partial wall and get back into the country? So there's a real public safety interest in the Trust Act, and to make sure that local and state law enforcement gets to hold people who've committed crimes responsible, committed, violated their state criminal laws responsible.
This week, State Senator Terry Bryant, who's a Republican from Murfreesboro in Southern Illinois, she posted the following on social media, quote, "If you are Illinois Department of Corrections staff who wants ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, to know of an illegal immigrant in IDOC, call or message me. I won't rat you out. I will notify ICE." What do you think of that?
I really don't think of it. I don't know. I mean, I think it's a publicity stunt. I think she must have a lot of time on her hand and wants to get some attention.
What about the substance of it? I mean, should Department of Corrections workers be notifying ICE if there's,
Well, that's good. That's a workaround the state law. Right? And so for a legislator to try to find a workaround a state law, I think, whether you were opposed to state law when you were in the legislature and it was passed, we're a nation of laws, right? And as a legislator, there may be some laws that I may have voted against. I spent 14 years in the legislature, but it is my duty as a citizen and certainly as a public official to abide by the laws, even if I opposed them being passed. It's unfortunate that we have a public official trying to skirt the law. But I will add, what I do know as a result of partnering with federal law enforcement officials, and they've got the capacity of checking publicly available websites that tells you who's in our Department of Correction and who's not. And so they're pretty skilled on their own. I don't think they need Terry Bryant's help with that.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce my conversation. This is an interview I taped late Friday afternoon with Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul. He's a Democrat in his second term. We're going to continue with more on immigration and other legal aspects of the Trump administration that are top of mind for he and his office. Because this part of our program is on tape, we are not taking calls live, but you can always let us know what you think about our program by emailing talk@21stshow.org, talk@21stshow.org. All right, more to come after the break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us. This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Let's get back to my conversation with Illinois Attorney General Kwame Raoul. Before the break, we were talking about immigration enforcement and how Illinois was responding to that, as well as birthright citizenship. As we were taping this conversation, again, on Friday afternoon, there was word coming out of Chicago that some Chicago Public School officials thought that ICE agents had showed up at a school. It turned out, we didn't know this yet as we were taping, but it turned out that that wasn't quite accurate. They were officials from the Department of Homeland Security, but they were with the Secret Service, and they were investigating a threat against a protectee of the Secret Service, not immigration officials. This was at a predominantly Hispanic school where they had shown up, and officials did say this does point up the level of fear that is happening in Latino communities. And it also gets at the idea of what could happen to officials who resist immigration authorities. The members of the Trump administration have pledged that they will prosecute state and local officials who stand in the way of federal immigration enforcement. And I asked Attorney General Raoul about that.
It's sad. It's sad. And they have indicated, you know, that sensitive places like schools would be, and churches would be targeted. And really, beyond our discussion on what is the law and what is the constitutional, what's not, there's a certain sadness of trying to just use fear in places like churches and schools. It really rattles a community. And what we will soon learn as a result of this, it's not in the best interest of our country. This past election was determined in part, in heavy part, on at least the American people's perception of who's responsible for high prices and things of that nature. We will soon come to learn how much we rely on the labor of undocumented immigrants in farms, for our food industry, grocery stores, restaurants, factories, construction. And it's going to have an impact, just the fear that's being put out there. It will have a impact on prices. You know, if people are not going, are fearful of going to work. And so we begin to ask ourselves, you know, let's set the debate up about the law aside for just one moment. Is this in the best interest? I don't question the interest of carrying out immigration enforcement. It's been done under Democrat administrations and Republican administrations. That's why we have an agency.
Progressives called President Obama the deporter in chief.
In his last year in particular, he was, I believe, more aggressive than Trump was in all four of his years, right? So the question is, how do you do it? Do you do it with due process? Are we looking at comprehensive immigration reform in a way that takes into account the reality of the extent to which we rely on this labor, the extent to which these are taxpayers, people in our community that are helping our community? There's a perception that's being put out there that, oh, these are the criminals. The overwhelming percentage of criminal activity is being committed by American citizens, not by undocumented immigrants, and that carries out to even per capita.
You mentioned earlier being a birthright baby. In fact, your parents immigrated to the U.S. from Haiti. As you well know, Haitian immigrants were a focus of Trump's rhetoric during the campaign, like the false statement about, they're eating the dogs, they're eating the cats, and so on, during his debate with then Vice President Harris. Talk about that. Talk about how, did your family feel welcomed in a way that, did your parents ever talk about that in a way that maybe is different from now? Or did they face discrimination of that sort?
Certainly they faced discrimination simply because they were Black in the 50s, right? My father came here as a physician, so I assume he had a special visa for professionals because of the need for doctors at the time. He initially came to New York. Both of my parents, they actually met in New York, not in Haiti. My mother initially came as a student. She was sick and had to go back and came back. She worked in furniture, the furniture textile industry. So she was a sweatshop worker for a while. She was not a citizen at the time of my birth. Listen, I'm nonpartisan in terms of my criticism of how Haitian immigrants in particular have been treated. I was critical of the Biden administration for the repatriation of Haitian immigrants at a time when there was unquestionable unrest in Haiti, when lives are being threatened, or the very reason why people are given asylum hearings in the first place. Those causes were unquestionably true and present in Haiti as they are today. Nobody can question the sad condition, the dangerous environment that exists in the capital of Haiti and surrounding areas right now. The sort of racist treatment of Haitian immigrants in particular it is disturbing to me, no matter what administration it comes from. I can throw out equal opportunity shade to both Democrat and Republican administrations on the disparate treatment of Haitian immigrants in particular. But just broadly speaking, we have to come to a reckoning as to, as I said before, the extent to which I had an opportunity to come upon and meet again, Governor DeWine of Ohio at the White House over the holidays. And he and I had previously met him when I was a state senator, and Senator Durbin had invited me to go to Haitians, and DeWine was a senator. And he has actually done some mission work in Haiti and his affinity for Haiti. And he quickly dispelled these rumors about cats and dogs. And he shared with me at this meeting at the White House the extent to which these workers were invited to Springfield, Ohio, because they were needed in Springfield, Ohio. That's just an example of what exists throughout the country. Ohio is unquestionably what we call a red state, but they're relying on these immigrants for necessary work that they need to get done for the betterment of their community and the betterment of the state. And we need to stop lying. We need to stop pretending like we don't rely on these people, that these people are not taxpayers. They're taxpayers that don't get the full benefit of the taxes that they're paying.
Attorney General Kwame Raoul, thank you for taking the time and sharing your perspective with us.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.